From Sky News Centre at 5. Detectives are questioning four people in connection with the stabbing of a 15-year-old boy outside a school in South London. Witnesses claim the teenager was targeted in ambush by suspected rival gang members when he was attacked outside Park Campus School in West Norwood. It has around 80 pupils who have social, behavioural and emotional difficulties. These local residents want it closed down.
It's changed the area a lot because, like, for example, you're walking down the road every day, all you see is police. The school needs to be closed down. And let somebody else use it for something better in the community, to join the children together.
Eight men from a drugs network stretching across South Wales, Kent and Bournemouth have been jailed for a total of nearly 80 years at Cardiff Crown Court. At the height of the operation, the gang was importing and distributing cocaine with a street value of £250 million a year. The public will get to choose the way our MPs are elected. A referendum is expected to be announced for next May on plans to introduce a new voting system. Problems on the new iPhone 4 are the fault of the handset's software and not its hardware. Some users have complained about poor signal strength, but Apple says they'll issue a free software update. Tennis: Andy Murray has lost the first set against Rafael Nadal in their semi-final at Wimbledon. Let's cross live to the All England Club. Our reporter Simon Owen is watching.
Well, Nadal edged it by 6-4, but this really has been close. Murray with some top-class serving, Nadal responding with his trademark massive forehand shots, but Nadal got the crucial break when it mattered, winning the ninth game when Murray was serving. It's all square in the second set at 3-3. These two playing for the right to meet Thomas Berdych in Sunday's final after he beat Novak Djokovic.
Football: five-time winners Brazil are out of the World Cup after losing their quarter-final against Holland 2-1. Meanwhile, the FA's to stick with Fabio Capello as England manager, the Italian's to keep his £6 million a year salary. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
If drink is costing you more than money, then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory, www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. After the 6 o'clock news, in July 2005, four explosions on London's public transport system claimed 56 lives on what has become known as 7-7. 5 years on, survivors, victims' families and the families of the four alleged bombers are still calling for a public inquiry with the power to force witnesses from the police and MI5 to answer questions, such as why did they lie, saying the alleged bombers were not under surveillance. The fifth anniversary of the 7-7 attack comes up on Wednesday next week, so tonight we'll be doing our own inquiry into the murky world of Britain's counter-terrorism security service, MI5, who take millions of public money every year to prevent such attacks, but when they fail, interests of national security seem to put them above the law. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but here's our two-weekend weather forecast first from MetCheck.com, which is in here somewhere. First of all, this weekend, temperatures averaging 20 degrees Celsius. That's in the daytime, dry with plenty of sun, sunnier on Saturday. Next week, averaging 21 degrees Celsius, and that is mainly dry with plenty of sun. Possible rain, though, on Friday. Next weekend, the 10th and 11th of July, averaging again 20 degrees Celsius. Sunny spells with a little rain next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Now I'm joined by Charlotte Leslie. Charlotte, let me just say thank you for coming and welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks very much, Tony.
Now, first of all, what brought you into politics?
What brought me into politics? Well, it was basically, I think, spending so much of my life sitting on the sofa, waving my fists at the news and saying, that's so wrong, that after a while I thought it's actually less tiring and less frustrating to stand up and try and do something about everything that's going on, be it local or be it, you know, what's going on in the world, than just to sit on the sidelines. So I thought, come on, Charlotte, put your money where your mouth is and try and get involved.
So what's your background? What were you doing before you became an MP?
Oh, I've done all sorts of things. When I left university, all my friends seemed to know exactly what they were doing. They'd all seemed to sort out something. And I was at university for 4 years, that 4 years. And they all went off into really well-paid, important jobs, like law and bankers and all sorts of stuff, and I didn't know what I was doing. So I postponed the decision, applied for a master's, and went to America for the summer of 2001. And it was when I was in America, I was there for 9/11, and I was in Chicago, and I saw the planes fly into the buildings, thought, goodness me, the world's literally blowing up out there. I've got to be part of it. So I went back, cancelled my master's, and I thought, there's two things that affect the world around me. There's media and there's politics. And I thought, I don't think I'm a politician, because I thought they were all grey and boring. And I quite fancied media. So I worked in TV for several years, worked on The Weakest Link and The Holiday Programme, which was very interesting. And in the meantime, I worked as a swimming teacher, and during my university summers, I worked as a surf lifeguard on the beaches in North Cornwall. And that was very interesting. I worked alongside the Coast Guard and the emergency services. And I'll tell you what, when you're working on the beach like that, a deadline isn't just when your boss says, I want these papers on my desk by 5 o'clock. A deadline really, it does mean a deadline.
So why the Conservative Party? Why not one of the other parties?
People often ask me that, and I went into politics to make things more equal. There's huge, huge inequality in Bristol, some of the best schools, some of the worst schools. And I went in to make society more equal. And often people say to me, well, isn't that what Labour does? But the reason I didn't join the Labour Party was, whilst I appreciated what they were trying to do, I felt that the Labour Party tended to put a small number of people in government that would then tell everybody else what to do. And I was never very good at school with small numbers of people telling everyone else what to do. And I thought, hang on a sec, the people telling everyone else what to do are far less equal than the people they're telling to do stuff. And Conservatives very much believe that power belongs to the people. So it means a government that supports people when you need it, but not a government that's constantly nagging people about every aspect of their daily lives.
But the trouble is, for many politicians, it's almost impossible to rise up through the party ranks and into the cabinet, etc., unless you just sort of kowtow to the bosses and do what you're told.
Well, there's that impression. One thing that I've found in my short time of being in Parliament is that I don't think you get much respect if you're a complete pansy to the whips. People just say, oh, they're a complete pushover. And a lot of the time, I mean, if you don't agree with the basic principles of what your party's doing, you should probably think about where you are. But there's David Cameron's been great because he's introduced a lot of free votes, which means you can have your personal opinion. And I've always said, you know, politics is a job. You've got to live and die with yourself. And I don't want to spend my last 5 minutes of life thinking, oh, well, I pleased the whips, but actually I sacrificed every principle I ever had. So you've always got to keep it in perspective.
So how do you see your mission then? I mean, what do you think you're going to achieve in the next 5 years?
Do you know what? If I had a plan for what I was going to achieve, I certainly wouldn't have thought I was going to be an MP. And if I would have been so alarmed by the plan I'd set myself, I'd have probably done nothing. But in broad terms, just do what I can. I mean, even being a candidate, I've learned that you really can change things. You know, we saved a piece of land called the Lamplighters Land in Shire Hampton. As a candidate, I took a big step and helped St Ursula's School on its way to becoming an academy. I've set up street dance classes. I've helped a boxing club expand. Now, as a candidate, you don't actually have that many more powers than a normal person. You know, you've got connections, but you're not different that much from ordinary people. And it was a real lesson in how you can actually just change things about you in small ways. And I suppose as an MP, I want to learn the ropes of Parliament, which, you know, it's a very grand place and it's very easy to get carried away with all the pomp and circumstance. But at the end of the day, it's only a tool. It's a tool to help your constituency and it's a tool to serve the nation. So I want to get used to that place, a bit like driving a car, and work out how I can use that place to best help my constituents.
Now, there's been a lot of talk over the last few days about MPs being really hamstrung by this new expenses system. I imagine you've had to grapple with that over the last few weeks. How's it been going?
It's to be honest, it's been an absolute nightmare, because what I'm really worried about, and what the big shame of it is after the awfulness of what happened with the MP's expenses scandal, you really needed a really strong, competent, firm authority that everyone respected to come into place and say, this is what we're doing, and have some sensible rules that everyone could follow without question. Instead, what's happened is you've got this extremely expensive organisation that has extremely well-furnished, nice offices that set up a sequence of rules that just shows it doesn't understand what an MP's job is. And I mean, I'll give you an example. One of the rules it's put down is it's reduced the amount of money that MPs can spend on their constituency offices. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but MPs spending money on their constituency offices to make sure they've got disability access and they're visible and accessible for their constituents was never a major complaint of the public, and there weren't major abuses there, but that's something they've clamped down on. And for someone like me who spent 3.5 years fighting a seat, don't get paid for doing it, I had to give up my job in the last 8 months really, I'm absolutely broke. And IPSA says, this is the independent standards body that's been set up, it says you've got to pay out of your own bank account things like you know, your if you have a flat in London, a lot of my office expenses, you have to pay it out of your own personal bank account, and then they refund you. If I do that, I'm going to be absolutely sunk, because I've a bit like Liam, but I have no more money. I really don't have very much money after 3.5 years, and I'm not the only one. And my fear is because IPSA isn't competent, people won't respect it, and we'll end up in a situation where some MPs may do rash things because the organisation is so bad, and we'll end up with another collapse of trust in the political system, which I really fear. I hope it won't happen, because we can't cope with another one.
Now, The Guardian yesterday's one of the headlines was saying MPs are threatening not to sign off new expenses watchdog budget. So it sounds like there might even be a showdown between the MPs and the, what did you say it's called again?
It's IPSA, the IPSA. Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority.
So if they cause too much trouble, do you think you would be in favour of actually refusing to sign off their budget as an MP?
I mean, I don't just go and sign things. I'd have to look at what the case was for it. But if they're not making good use, but don't forget, these are taxpayers' money as well. If they're not making good use of taxpayers' money, I think people should be asking why. I don't know why they have such beautiful offices. I don't think that's a very good use of taxpayers' money. And I think people deserve to know what's going on. But it'll be a huge shame if it comes to that, because it's just delaying the process of really getting politics sorted out again. So I hope it doesn't have to come to that. And I really hope that IPSA is able to show that it's a competent value for money organisation, and you know, get a bit of authority and respect that it should have.
Now, Martin Summers is joining us too, our old Labour Oxford economist as ever. Martin, what are your thoughts on this story we've heard this week about the expenses body, with MPs actually threatening to withdraw funding for it effectively?
Well, as you know, Tony, I mean, a lot more money has been spent on prosecuting and dealing with this problem than was actually at stake in the MP's expenses. So people have rather lost proportion about this. Also, of course, when the MP's expenses scandal broke 18 months ago, whatever, it was a massive distraction from the real problems that we had with the private bankers basically paying themselves huge bonuses and thumbing their noses at the rest of society. And the people could get their heads around what was happening with MPs. A £4,000 duck pond, which never actually got agreed, is something people can understand. But when you talk about £4 billion with lots of noughts on the end that the bank have just lost, that's way beyond people's capacity to think it through. So I saw the whole expenses scandal as largely a diversion from what people needed to be really thinking about. And that's not to say that there were not abuses. Clearly there were. Another abuse which has not been dealt with is this whole question of whether MPs should have second jobs. I don't know whether Charlotte's got a second job, but I know many MPs do have other jobs as well as being MPs. Now, in what other section of the public sector are you allowed to have a job as an MP and another job doing something else? You're supposed to be full-time on your main job if you're an employee of the public sector. Now, this is a serious question, because it brings up the issue of who can be an MP. Well, maybe only people who've got private means. I mean, originally MPs were not paid in the distant past, and they had to have private means. And having them properly remunerated for what they do, and also covering their basic expenses like having proper offices, this is a cost of democracy. And I think probably Charlotte and I would see eye to eye about this. It's very much important that we do fund the democratic process properly and transparently. and so that people can have confidence in what's going on.
Now, Charlotte, I mean, I'm sure there's some people out there thinking, here the MPs go again, you know, they're not happy with anything. So what would, how would you answer people who would say, you've just simply got to do what you're told?
Well, to be honest, personally, I'm getting paid for the first time in quite a long time. I've been paid more than I've ever been paid before. So personally, I'm extremely happy. And my only worry is that if you have an authority that doesn't have respect, then things are going to go wrong. Now, that happens whether it's a head teacher, whether it's IPSA, whether it's anything at all. I can see how people think that, and I think the important thing in politics is to maintain perspective and maintain perspective on what you're there to do. You're there to serve your constituency, save the taxpayer money and get on with the job. Now, if IPSA is genuinely getting in the way of that, then there's a case to take measures against it. If it's not, just lump it and get on with it.
Now, I know you've got an interest, a special interest in education. Can you tell us why?
That's a big question. I mean, education, for me, is where everything starts. If you have a nation of people who've been educated to fulfil their potential, you have a nation of happier, healthier people, the economy runs better, health outcomes are better, family relationships are better. Everything stems from education. It's where life chances are won or lost. And it's always been something that struck me as particularly unfair that where you come from, what your family background is, can dictate the kind of school you go to and then the life chances you have in the future. And that was one of the things from as far back as I can remember, just lit that kind of fire in my belly, and I thought, that is just wrong. I don't care about the reasons. I want to look at the reasons and try and tackle it. So for me, that's where everything starts.
Now, Marina Morris is joining us, and Marina has a special report this week about education.
Bristol has a significant tradition of private education. This office of Bristol children attending an independent school. The vision for Bristol 2020 plan regarding education and young people. The plain aim to create the environment, the inspiring to have a good education in something to be proud of, or something to work for, and something that is regarded by young people's peers as normal. Childhood is the most important time when schools program child's mind. It means schools create values, beliefs and future behavioral attitude which will influence their decision during life and pay back as citizens of the future. What is the mission of school and education in the 21st century? The time needs not only academic learning, which is incredibly important. A modern education should include obtaining knowledge and skills which help children to build up a strong personality, to compete in today's high-pressure game of life and win this game. It is important that children obtain a vision of their desired future, a dream of what they wish to become, and a plan of how to proceed towards their life's targets. A good quality of life, this long life expectancy, is important. Not just process of living for the sake of living. The result is seeking to obtain quality from life. Do we teach children to have this vision and attitude, to face life from this point of view? Have children been trained how to deal with this difficult situation and feeling, how to be in harmony with themselves? Life skills, education, self-respect, self-esteem can benefit them and possibly even protect their future from drug abuse, alcohol abuse, depression, and many other ills of society. It should be a child's personal choice to be or not to be healthy, successfully, and feel beautiful. The mission of good education is to highlight these choices. The role of a good modern teacher and a good school is vital. Can children learn these values and attitudes from an enthusiastic teacher who focuses them into being a part of the crowd? Education has to inspire children to be passionate toward their life tenure, to have dreams and the power and techniques to manage these dreams and to turn vision into reality. A good education will reward society to have a better and healthier future. These successful children obtaining satisfaction in future career, life, and happy parents. And locally, Sons Ursula schools in Lawrence Weston, and school with a history of excellent academic result, has announced that it is seeking academy status. If successful, Sons Ursula's convent will become the third private school in Bristol after Colston Girls' School and Bristol Cathedral School to become academies. The coordination school, which currently has about 200 4 to 16 all students, is planning a change to create places for 700 local children, although the capacity of its existing buildings is 374 and future funding for new buildings is likely to be restricted. The school's governor says the decision was prompted by financial pressures resulting from the recession and calls from local parents group for a good state secondary in the northwest of the city. The scheme proposed would be run by Oasis Community Learning. Oasis would have to underwrite debts of £700,000 and come up with a viable package to run the school as a fee-charging school for children aged 4 to 16 for the next year and then to turn it into academy after that. Recently, however, Colston Girls' School, which already has academy status, announced plan to open a primary school, a boys' secondary school and a sixth form college on the site of the St. Ursula schools next year. How this would might affect the youngest children already at St. Ursula, many of those parents have already paid substantial fees up front, appears unclear.
Thanks, Marina. Now, Charlotte, you, I think, were a governor, weren't you, at St. Ursula's?
Yes, that's right. I was a governor until quite recently, and I was chair of governors until the election came along, and then I was unable to talk to civil servants about the academy bid because I was seeking to be elected representative, a political person, and so I stood down as chair because there was not an awful lot I could do in that position.
Now, also reading in today's Evening Post that schools are being told apparently not to rush to be academies. The unions are saying it would be wrong to make a decision about St Ursula's in haste before the full details are revealed of how the scheme will work. They're particularly concerned that the Academy's bill, which is intended to become law later this month, does not insist that schools consult parents, staff and the community and the local authority before changing their status. Now, does that bother you?
There's always been, right from the time when Tony Blair began introducing academies, there's always been scare stories about what academies will do. And the point about what Michael Gove is saying is not that he's forcing schools to become academies. All he's saying is to teachers and head teachers who feel ground down and worn down by the kind of bureaucracy that comes out of local authorities and the kind of restrictions that are placed on them, saying, look, if you want to be free from that, you can be. Not you must be, but if you feel you've got better ways of running your school and you're feeling held back by your current situation, we're going to let those reins loose and we're going to let you succeed.
But what the NUT is saying here, the teachers' union, is that why can't you allow the people, the staff of the school, the pupils, not necessarily the pupils, but the parents, to make the decision? You've got to persuade them first, surely, that this is a good idea.
I mean, the whole point about Michael Gove's education reforms is that it puts parents much more in the driving seat. If you look at what's happened in the past, parents have wanted certain things to happen to schools, and a bit like computer says no, local authority has always said no. I mean, look at Northwest Bristol. The bid to get a new secondary school for Northwest Bristol has been going on for almost 20 years. Parents make a brilliant case time after time after time, go to the local authority says no. So to be honest, if there's anyone standing in the way of what the public opinion wants, I think often it can be a local authority.
But don't you think it should just then what we should be doing is just changing the staff at the local authority, making sure we've got some more enlightened people there?
I wonder, without pointing any fingers at all, you're not the first person to say that about this particular local authority, although I know everyone works to do a very good job.
Martin, what's your thoughts on these academies? Because, I mean, many people, rightly or wrongly, see this as a privatisation, essentially, of education.
Well, effectively, what's happening, we're getting a semi-privatised system. And, we're getting, instead of having secondary moderns and grammar schools, we've now got a whole tier of different kinds of schools, some of which are well regarded, some of which are badly regarded. My father was a head teacher of comprehensive schools in inner city areas for many years, and he took early retirement in the 80s when the Conservatives were last in power because of the choice agenda that was being pushed. Because, of course, when we talk about parents, you've got to remember that a substantial number of children do not have parents who are very interested in their education. So if we're relying on their parents to push them forward, then nothing much is going to happen for those kids. And what we've now got is a situation where we're going to have a fragmented system. One thing I would say about a fragmented system, it's much more expensive than having a planned system. So all this stuff about we can't afford this and we can't afford that, having this kind of choice is much more expensive. We just heard earlier that the school has only got space for 300 and some odd pupils and a waiting list to, so the buildings, extra buildings will have to be built, or porta cabins will have to be put up or whatever. Now, ultimately, you've got to have some kind of standard offer for children, wherever they come from, whatever their background is, and it shouldn't depend upon whether you're in the catchment area of this school or that school. And this philosophy, I'm afraid, has gradually been eroded, first by the previous Conservative government and then by New Labour, although New Labour were saying that academies could only be failing schools, as City Academy was, or in its inner city areas. Now successful schools can be academies. What we're going to find is, as with the universities, is that there's now going to be a huge kind of list of which, when you say you've got a university degree, they'll say, oh, but which university? And when you say you, when you, some schools will do well out of this, because of course the real problem is kids that don't do well in school and get kicked out of school. My sister works in a unit with kids who have been refused from all the local schools. Now, these are the children who don't have the parental backing that actually are going to lose out under these kind of proposals. There's a real danger that they're just going to fall through the net and be ignored.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what it's important to realise about this is there's things that grab headlines, and this is one of the headline-grabbing education policies. But as well, there is a huge raft of stuff that we are proposing and need to do about the children who fall through the gaps. A few years ago, I authored a report called The Invisible Children, all about the kids who never even get to take their GCSEs, just disappear off the radar. And things like, I mean, there's initiatives that are already very good at catching those young people and keeping them, be it a boxing club, be it anything else, keeping them in some kind of loop in which they're able to reintegrate back into education. Things like giving teachers more power over disciplining their class so that a small minority of kids can't disrupt the whole of the rest of the class. Because at the moment, many teachers feel terrorised by children. The minute they try and discipline them, the child can turn around and say, "Don't touch me, sir, you touch me, sir." And that's a terrible thing because the other children suffer. So this has got to be seen within that context. One thing I should point out is that, and I don't want to point fingers here, but Labour ministers are very, very good at doing this. They say, I'm sending my child to a state school. In fact, if you look at it, it's often a church-run school, state school, in a very nice area where they have to spend a lot of money to buy a house. Now, why should they have the privilege of going to a state school because they can afford a house, where a group of very vocal parents who want a good school let set up in their area, and I know some parents don't have the proverbial sharp elbows if they live in disadvantaged areas, but it's very condescending. That's not all parents, and there are parents in all sorts of areas who say, we want a new school. These aren't sharp-elbowed middle-class parents. They're parents from modest backgrounds who simply want a decent chance for their child, like government Labour ministers, ex-government Labour ministers, who are able to buy a house in a nice catchment area and still have the moral luxury of saying, I'm sending my child to a state school. Final point, we're losing from Bristol Local Authority, because the local authority has not met the demands of parents and the needs of parents, 15 million a year. Because at the end of the day, people are human. You've got to look at what works and what actually happens. People will simply go out of the local authority to other schools or go private. Now, that's a fifth. Around a fifth of Bristol children every year do that, costs around 15 million. That doesn't make sense. By sticking your head in the sand and being all ideological about it, you don't help anyone.
Now, talking about some of the areas which are basically poorer areas and rougher schools, if you want, there's been a big change this week, has been announced, and from yesterday in Parliament, one of the BBC's programmes, here's a little clip of some of the changes that are being made at the moment to the previous Labour programme of extending the free school meals.
The most impassioned speech came from the new Labour MP for West Ham, Lynn Brown, whose constituency takes in the London borough of Newham, where another of the pilot schemes is operating. She said extending free school meals to low-income working families could save them up to £1,000 a year.
And although some of us might not understand what £600 per year or £1,000 per year means to a working family, because actually, for some of us, it's less than what we would spend on a weekend away. But for my families, for the people I represent, it can be the difference between surviving or not. And that is the damage that taking away the free school meals programme, the universal free school meals programme, is likely to do.
The Shadow Schools Minister, Diana Johnson, was in full support.
On the working families tax credit eligibility, which I think was a very sensible approach and would fit in very well with the coalition government's attempt to get people into work, I think it is very short-sighted indeed, as many honourable members have said today, to have abandoned that particular policy.
But a Conservative MP, George Freeman, was getting fed up with what he saw as a traducing of the minister's position.
The government is not proposing to scrap the pilot, nor indeed, contrary to some impressions given in some places, to scrap free school meals, which is the impression given, that the pilot is to continue. What we're not doing is extending the pilot, which it turns out was an unfunded promise by the former government, and having inherited bankrupt public finances, it would be irresponsible to continue to do something that there is no money for.
That point was taken up by the Schools Minister, Tim Lawton, when he replied to the debate. Over 3 years, the extension of the Labour scheme would cost £295 million, he said.
And I think it's actually immoral. By leading people to believe the previous government could extend the free school meal programme without making any provision for how that was going to be funded.
Well, obviously, I'm not very happy about free school meals being cut. Obviously, there's an issue about them being extended.
But why did Labour promise this? I mean, with £295 million they didn't have.
Well, the question is, why don't we have the money? It's because the private banking system's collapsed, and that's a much bigger issue that needs to be addressed. And, of course, many people have made a lot of money out of that and are still making money out of it. I think that I would agree with Jamie Oliver that we actually ought to provide decent school meals for free for everybody. If we're talking about health and education, I mean, that ought to be a goal that we ought to be thinking about as a society, I think.
So, Charlotte, why is your party cutting these free school meal programmes at the very time when people are being made redundant and their disposable income's going down in the poorest areas?
This is a story that's been happening again and again and again. One of the most frustrating things of coming into government is you realise the last government knew it was going to lose and simply spent its last dying moments making life as difficult as possible for the next incumbents. So it promised all sorts of things it knew it couldn't deliver and started spending money rapidly so there was no money to spend. I think it's absolutely appalling because it was putting politics above the people. It was playing with people's hopes and expectations simply to score a few political points like this one and get the media all excited when the new government has to come in and face an enormous record-breaking budget deficit left by a government with a Chancellor who sold off the gold at the lowest possible price and just hasn't had the foresight to set aside for a rainy day.
Martin, I think isn't it wonderful now we've got the Conservatives here, because the financial mismanagement under Gordon Brown and Tony Blair was absolutely horrendous, wasn't it?
I'm not, in fact, a defender of everything that they've done, as Charlotte would possibly realise. I mean, many people in the Labour Party weren't very happy with some of the things they did. I think the fundamental problem we've got to confront is that the private banking system imploded. We should have known it was going to implode, and many people in the Labour Party with an economics background like myself knew it was going to implode. And when they say that nobody saw this coming, plenty of people saw it coming. Plenty of people in the universities certainly saw it coming.
Well, you're on YouTube, Martin, aren't you? Seeing it coming about 2.5 years ago.
Yeah. Now the fact is that the collapse of the private banking system led to a situation where we could either allow the private banking system to collapse, carrying down large chunks of private industry with it, or we throw the Thatcherite textbook out of the window and prop the banks up. And everybody agreed at the time that that's what we would do. Now, of course, once you've done that, all you're doing is treading water. You're not actually solving the problem. The fundamental problem is that a large section of our society at the top have actually done very well out of the neoliberal policies of the last 30 years under Conservatives and New Labour. But a lot of that was what von Hayek and von Mises would call malinvestment. That is to say, there were no real profits. The banks are still bankrupt, despite what people say. And in actual fact, we've got to take the money back from those wealthy people who've done very well out of the last 30 years to plug the hole in the national finances, not take school meals off the poorest sections of our society. It's actually a zero-sum game here. It's a zero-sum game. We've got to get the deficit down. That's quite right. We can't just spend our way out of recession. Although, of course, I would make the point that the idea that we've got to balance the books has been absolutely discredited. We are now in a Keynesian universe, not a Milton Friedman universe. Now, that means that we can have more, we've all agreed that we can have deficit spending, but of course we can't overdo that. Now, if there's a hole in the deficit, if there's a hole in the finances, the public finances, it doesn't mean cutting public expenditure. Cutting public expenditure will in fact not even reduce the deficit, because we will, as in the 1980s or the 1930s, you will actually spend more in the end as a proportion of GDP. So in other words, we've got to actually throw the economics textbook of the last 30 years out of the window and pick the old one out of the waste paper basket which we've thrown it into. We managed our economy quite successfully from the 1940s to the 1970s on a completely different basis from the one we've subsequently managed to get ourselves into a mess with. We need to go back and start again, and that means high taxes on wealth and income.
Now, Charlotte, in the run-up to the election, both Labour and Liberal were talking about leaving the cuts for a while just to make sure the economy was actually stable. Don't you think we're now in danger of going into a double-dip recession because of these immediate cuts?
There are so many points to answer in that. First thing is, Labour had 13 years, or has had all the time since the banking crisis, to introduce a bank levy. It was the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats that actually went ahead and did it. The second thing, and this comes from my experience of sitting on the benches opposite the Labour benches, is I've been absolutely mesmerised, puzzled and bewildered how perfectly bright, sensible people can A, look smug about their record over the last 13 years and B, still say we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to spend more on this, when the money isn't there. I mean, it's the equivalent of a family who have, you know, no disposable income at all saying, well, we want to go on a really plush holiday on a yacht, so why can't we just do it? It's extraordinary. The reason why we've had to change our plans is very simple, because if we don't tackle our plans, we're going to have a 70 billion interest payment on our debt. Now, that's not our debt, that's simply the interest we're paying for the privilege of having that debt. That's money completely down the drain. Now, last year it was 42 billion. To put into perspective, that's as much as we're spending on schools. So that every week it goes up by 3 billion. Now, this is money you could be spending on the poor, you could be spending on the vulnerable, but no, we're throwing it away because the deficit is so massive, because there's been this idea that the budget deficit doesn't really matter, don't really want to upset the apple cart, so we're going to continue to fund that 70 billion potential interest on that debt just because we don't want to take decisions that may make us politically unpopular. Now, I'm delighted that the coalition is in place, because finally it means you can put politics aside, put policy first, and actually do the right thing for the country.
Now, Martin, why have Labour been spending money hand over fist, especially in the run-up to the election, when it's not there?
Well, there may be elements of them, as Charlotte has suggested, spending money because they thought they were going to lose, and therefore they don't mind about
it. Absolutely unforgivable.
But I would also point out that the rescue of the banking system was a necessary thing, as everybody recognises. The problem is that the big bang in the city in the 1980s allowed the private banks to do all sorts of things they weren't allowed to do from the 1930s till the 1980s. A bank levy is all very well, but it's not nearly enough. We are on the brink, not of a double dip recession, but of a depression, which is possibly going to run for 10 or 15 years. And we're probably only going to get out of it with a further war. We're not actually in normal times. We're actually in very abnormal times. The Labour Party front bench and many of the people in Parliament are culpable because they did not reverse the Thatcherite reforms of the 1980s, and they allowed the City of London to carry on doing all of the things that it shouldn't have been doing, and they should have been told no a long time ago.
Two things, point to make. One of the big reasons we've suffered so much is that when the banks went boom, or they went bust in fact, went boom in a bad sense and went bust, our manufacturing industry was decimated. Little known fact, manufacturing declined more over the 13 years of Labour than it's done ever before, far more than under Thatcher. Under Labour, the manufacturing industry absolutely plummeted and the UK became a far less competitive place to be. So that's one of the problems. Second issue is, when Gordon Brown came in and granted independence to the Bank of England, which we all supported, creating the tripartite system meant that there was no real accountability. No one really knew what was going on. Now, the Conservatives mentioned that at the time, said the FSA has always been a toothless authority. So I think it's a bit disingenuous to blame the entire thing on Thatcher when it was Gordon Brown came in and made reforms that made the city a far less stable place and also put in place measures to take away the limits of banks borrowing against their assets. That limit was removed and then banks could just go crazy, which is what's happened.
Well, I actually don't disagree with that. I think what's happened is that the political class as a whole have bought into the neoliberal ideology. And I was interested before the election talking to Conservatives on this programme. Are you prepared to recognise that the neoliberal ideology is dead? It's finished. This idea that the private sector, I mean, we're actually gambling on the idea that the private sector is magic and it's somehow going to rescue us as long as we don't have too big a state sector. Now, in actual fact, this is wrong. The private sector and the public sector are interrelated. interrelated. And of course, I didn't actually agree with the Bank of England being independent. I don't think there's much sense in it, because it implies that there's only technical issues involved, where in actual fact they're political issues. The Bank of England was nationalised in 1948 to be under government control. The FSA, I totally agree, was and the tripartite so-called regulation, a load of nonsense. But don't presume I'm defending official Labour policy here. That's not what I'm here for. I think that we all need to take a step back, because I think that it's the G20 have agreed massive spending cuts across the developed world. Most serious economists that I respect, people like Danny Blanchflower from the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, Joe Stiglitz, Paul Krugman, they're all saying this is crazy. We're treading water in an emergency. And just holding our breath and stopping treading water will not actually get us out of the emergency. We've got to carry on treading water, and we do have to rebuild the public finances, but not through cuts, through wealth taxes. Some people have done very well out of the last 30 years. It's time for them to pay up.
The trouble is, treading water is costing us in debt interest huge amounts of money.
Well, that's why we can't carry on just treading water.
OK, it's 6:22 now, and it's time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Charlotte Leslie's choice of music. Now, Charlotte, what have you chosen for us?
Well, I have to say, I was very disappointed. I bought a huge CD of my selection. I could only choose one. So together we chose Dizzy Rascal and Bonkers. My mum's taken up street dancing, which is what got me into this.
The baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I've got to get a grip, but I let Sonny E give me the slip. Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I'll get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
Bonkers.
Every day is a daydream. Everything in my life ain't what it seems. I wake up just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. And all I care about is sex and violence. And every baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but I let sanity give me the slip.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Yeah, man,
in the floor now.
Back then.
Back then.
I wake up every day is a daydream. Everything in my life ain't what it seems. I wake up just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. And all I care about is sex and violence. A heavy baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but I let sanity give me the slip. Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
You're listening to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. That was Bonkers by Dizzy Rascal, chosen by today's guest on BCFM, Charlotte Leslie, who's Conservative MP for Bristol North West. Now, back to our review of the week's news, and apparently, according to the Daily Mail yesterday, killers and sex attackers could be spared jail in Kenneth Clark's jail reform. Analysis of the short sentences he wants to replace with community sentences reveals that it will lead to thousands of serious criminals escaping a spell behind bars. In 2008, the last year for which there are figures, nearly 20,000 cases of theft, 7,000 of violence against the person and more than 4,000 burglary convictions attracted these lenient sentences of less than a year. More seriously, 80 people were convicted of conspiracy to commit murder, but also escaped with short prison terms. Anyway, so Charlotte, what is Ken Clark up to here? He's going to leave some of the most dangerous criminals just to roam the streets.
No one wants dangerous criminals roaming the streets, and that's obviously not what's not going to happen. Good old Daily Mail, but you can't believe everything they always say. But the point is, it is a really serious point, and it is a very difficult one as to what do you do with people who commit these kind of crimes, and what role does a short sentence play? Now, it's an easy fix to say, yeah, shove them away for a while, get them out of our hair, do their time, punishment enough, then let them out again. But what does that actually do? It's a very easy thing to say, but actually, reoffending rates are absolutely diabolical. And what's much more worrying is people go in for a relatively petty crime, come out a much more hardened criminal because they learn all sorts of bad habits, often pick up a drug habit. And that's the kind of thing that Ken Clark's been looking at. In addition...
I mean, surely the way to deal with that is just make sure that the drugs are kept out of prison.
Well, I mean, people have been trying to do that for a very long time. One of the problems is that prisons are so overcrowded that it's very difficult to do all the things that you should be doing in a prison, which is a lot of rehabilitation, making sure these people come out not as hardened, more hardened criminals, but as people more likely to settle down, get a job, look after their family.
Well, what about, I mean, call me naive if you want, but what about a sniffer dog or two?
You can, I mean, it's again, you know, you can introduce all those things. Prison's very innovative entrepreneurs, if you like, but it's proven very hard to do. And also mixing with people who've had a life of crime, perhaps above the league that you've gone in with, is not a good thing. Now, what has gone wrong, I think, in the past is that community sentences have been a really, really soft option. And so I think what is also to be looked at here is what the description of a community sentence is. And it's to be hard work. People are to wear placards saying that they're doing community service because of what they've done. And you've got to be practical about things. Although you might think, oh, that sounds like they're getting off scot-free. If it means they're actually going to learn some skills and come out from their community service, still not putting the public at risk, but with a few more skills and a bit more likely to contribute to society instead of offend again, can it be a bad thing?
Martin.
Well, I mean, broadly, I welcome what Ken Clark is doing here. I don't think Michael Howard's so keen, and I think the tensions within the coalition, within the Conservative Party, really, will come out over this. I think the real problem we've got with crime, as Charlotte has pointed out, prisons are universities of crime. They don't solve the problem. They just park it in a corner for a while, and then the problem reasserts itself. I think we've got to think about prison not just being for people from the bottom end of society as well. I mean, a lot of the people involved in these frauds inside the banks, they need to go to prison. During the savings and loan scandal in the 1980s in the US, hundreds of people, senior executives of savings and loans organisations, were sent to prison. The other thing that I think really needs to be looked at, and of course, again, we're not talking about this in the mainstream, is the legalisation of drugs, although Danny Kushlick did stand in Bristol West on that platform in the election. They run an NGO called Transform here in Bristol that argues in favour of that. Various senior politicians in Latin America have recently issued a report suggesting that this needs to be done, because a lot of people are in prison because they're involved in the drugs industry as consumers or as sellers or whatever, and a lot of this is actually generating crime and not actually stopping crime. And of course, you can't sue somebody for non-payment if you're involved in this industry. You have to go and settle it with a gun or what have you. I know that it's not very popular in the mainstream, and certainly not in the Daily Mail, to talk about these things, but in places like Colombia and Venezuela and other countries in Latin America, they are really coming to the conclusion that unless legalization and regulation takes place, then crime is just going to carry on growing. And don't forget that, of course, this links in with the banking crisis. A lot of this money is then money laundered through the traditional banks.
Okay, and we hear also this week that a jury has cleared activists who broke into a Brighton arms factory. And this is a group of activists, many of them, I think there's three or four of them actually, from Bristol, broke into a Brighton arms factory that was supposed to have been making parts that for missiles and things that were being sent over to Israel, and they've now been acquitted this week. Now, Martin, is this good news or bad news? Does it mean now that anybody can now just wander into an arms factory and start smashing it up with impunity?
No, I mean, the arms factory, this arms factory was supplying components for Israeli F-16s, which were involved in the attack on Gaza, and that's why I think the judge and the jury came to the conclusion that they did. When we had some activists from Bristol breaking into Fairford Air Base some years ago in the run-up to the Iraq War.
This is that big US air base in Gloucestershire.
It's in Fairford in Gloucestershire. They were not allowed to argue that they were preventing a crime, because that was the judge held in Bristol Crown Court, and they had two trials, that this was a matter for the British government and not to be decided by individuals. But in this case, the judge in the court made the jury read the Goldstone report into what had happened in Gaza, and basically directed the jury not to convict. I think it's a good day for British justice. I mean, judges and juries are there for a reason. It's a problem for the company, of course, because they are potentially fingered as being in breach of Britain's export guidelines to Israel, which is, if you export military equipment to Israel, it's not supposed to be used in the occupied territories for any act of repression. And this case has highlighted that, in fact, this may well be what's going on here. So I think this is an example of the system working. I know that there's a demonstration going on at the Centre for Bristol as we speak, and a lot of people in Bristol are quite happy with this result.
Charlotte, £180,000 worth of damage they did, and now they've just walked out of court scot-free.
It's a very difficult one, isn't it? Because I think most of us have an awful lot of sympathy with what they did. The question is to what extent one act where you can understand people's motivation and what you did should be a basis for changing the law. It's a very difficult one. I think what Caroline Lucas says is very interesting.
She's the Green MP down there in Brighton.
She's a Brighton Green MP. She said that all democratic paths have been exhausted, and I think that points to a very important thing, is we really need to make sure that we do give people the opportunity to make their voice heard in legal ways, because if we don't, people will turn to illegal options.
Now, there is supposed to be a lot of restrictions on arms and who they can go to make sure that they don't go to human rights abusers of one sort or another. Martin, Robin Cook, I think, was quite strong on this before he died, and he was Foreign Secretary. Do you think this is really possible, to make sure that arms only go to good countries that respect human rights?
Well, obviously, it's very difficult to make sure that's the case. And of course, Robin Cook famously agreed that the Indonesians should be allowed to have Hawk bombers from Britain. I think when I used to work for Amnesty some years ago, and one of the things that they were campaigning about particularly was small arms. Small arms are far more dangerous than some of the big stuff like submarines and so on, which very rarely get used. Small arms do get used. And what they've been campaigning for is a registration system for those who are selling small arms. That's not to say you can't sell small arms. If you want, I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and I would have been quite happy to see the Bosnian army armed by outside forces, but over the table, in full sight, so that everybody knows what's going on. What was actually happening is they were being armed under the table by the Americans. We need more transparency in arms sales. I'm not a pacifist. Sometimes people need to fight. Sometimes arms are necessary. But I think we've got a real problem in that our industry, our manufacturing industry, particularly in Bristol, is becoming skewed just towards military production, and that we are not actually, you know, we're not building a better widget. And once you're building military things, you've got to sell them, because you have to recoup your investment. So we've become a bit of a one-trick pony in Britain in this respect.
Charlotte, do you think we should be exporting arms to Israel?
Oh, it's a difficult one. As Martin says, people do have the right to fight, and I wouldn't, sitting here as an individual, want to make judgments on that enormous scale. I think Israel has a lot to answer, but it's a very horrible and complex, very sad situation.
So is that a yes?
Can I just cut in there? I mean, it's understood that they're not supposed to be supplied with weapons which are used in the occupied territories or for repression. This is why the judge and the jury have not convicted in this case. And that's not illegal. It's the company that's acting illegally, and that's why the decision has come out as it has.
Okay, next story. Methodist Conference votes to close Wesley College. That is the world's oldest theological college, which is based here in Bristol, is going to close. Martin, does it matter that Wesley College has to close? Apparently they've only got a few students. There's one side of them, the actual Methodist Conference, is saying they've only got three students, but other people, one of them is called Charity Hamilton, says that she's part of 400 people who have been campaigning, and there are about 100 still studying there. So does it matter that the world's oldest theological college based in Bristol is closing?
Well, it is a shame, since John Wesley did much of his original proselytisation in Bristol, and we've got Wesley's Chapel in the centre of the city. My mother was one of the first Church of England women priests, And I think that the real problems are not so much for the Methodists, it's the Catholics, of course, with their celibacy rule. They're finding it very difficult to recruit people to be priests. I'm surprised that the Methodists are closing their college, but I presume that they have reasons which are not entirely apparent to us, probably to do with money.
It's a great shame, and it would be wonderful if they could find some way to reorganise things. It looks like they're letting out large amounts of the buildings to keep the college going, particularly since it seems that there are almost 100 students there. It's only that three of them are needed for training for the ministry. But it's always interesting and almost encouraging how many young people still are training to go into the ministry. You know, it's in a quite a secular world, it's encouraging to see that young people still, you know, do have that kind of vocation.
Do you have a religious background yourself?
I do, yes.
And what is it?
I'm broadly Christian. I was brought up as Church of England, but I'm not very denominational.
No, as Church of England people tend to be.
Yeah, I think I'm very basic. Do good things to other people,
yes.
And that's about...
Keep it simple.
Exactly.
Now, one of the big stories this week's been the Russian spy ring captured by the FBI in the United States. And apparently 10 alleged Russian sleepers, that's illegals in spy lingo, have been arrested and are now being charged with working as agents of a foreign power. Even though, in many of the news reports, it's told us that they didn't actually really seem to be actually doing anything. They were just kind of sleepers who were sitting there waiting for something to happen, I imagine, in the future. Martin, what are your thoughts on this story? And how important is this, really, this spy ring?
Well, I mean, it's obviously we're still finding information out about what's supposed to have happened, so it's very hard to jump to conclusions. It does seem rather odd timing, because Obama had just met with Medvedev and seemed to be, you know, recalibrating his relationship with the Russians, and then suddenly this kicks in. And apparently they've been watching this so-called spy ring since the year 2000, so I would question the timing of this. It looks to me, just from the outside, and this is entirely speculation, that this is to do with internal politics within the US intelligence community, and that, you know, the timing is to do with embarrassment for the president, I would guess. But
well, I know there are apparently quite a lot of different spy agencies in the US, about 10 or so.
Well,
and of course,
yes.
One of the things they do is they have to try and vie for to be, oh, we are the most important agency, and this is a big incentive on them to find spy rings like this. What are your thoughts, Charlotte?
It just shows that the age of the Cold War story is always alive and kicking and will always get newspaper headlines, and I think that's a lot.
Especially
of
with this photogenic lady at the heart of it, the 28-year-old Anna Chapman. That she's been all over the papers, hasn't she?
Yes, and why is it, do you think, that big spy rings like this get so much publicity, but other spy rings that have been discovered in the United States, like the dancing Israelis just after 9/11, and also the Israeli art students, get hardly any publicity whatsoever?
Well, it's to do with the way the media is structured, isn't it? It's that this is a story that writes itself. You know, the Russians have been spying again. Yeah, so explaining that the Israelis actually spy on the Americans and stole their nuclear secrets and may have been involved in all sorts of skullduggery, that doesn't get covered, because that's not a mainstream thought that people have. They're our allies, aren't they? We supply them with weapons.
Now, whistleblower Annie Machon has pointed out that Graham Greene's novel Our Man in Havana is all about a spy agency that actually creates a fake group of spies in order to sort of increase their credibility. Just a final word on this one, Aunt Charlotte. Do you think we're going to be seeing more of this kind of thing going on as a sort of Cold War reviving again?
I have no idea. I'm sure the media will have a huge amount of appetite for it, particularly as the Obama saga rolls on. As a politician, you have to know what you don't know, and I know that I don't really know what's going on underneath this story, but it makes good reading, and we're talking about it today, which says enough, really.
Okay, and our final story, I think, for today. There's been lots of revelations this week about the apparent or alleged suicide of Dr. David Kelly in the immediate run-up to the Iraq war. We're being told that David Kelly could not have slit his wrist as he was too weak. This is the guy that died in Oxfordshire. Our new revelation, apparently this week in the Daily Mail, includes the ambiguous nature of the wording on Dr. Kelly's death certificate. And it's only just been revealed itself. His death certificate hadn't been properly filled in. The existence of an anonymous letter which says his colleagues were warned to stay away from his funeral, and an extraordinary claim that the wallpaper of Dr. David Kelly's home was stripped by police in the hours after he was reported missing, but before his body was found. Now, he'd been talking off the record to Andrew Gillingham at Radio 4. That was why he was being grilled and why apparently he was very annoyed and then committed suicide. But the question is, do you think this is unfinished business? Do you think we should just forget about this? Or do you think we're going to be seeing more of the whole David Kelly incident?
Well, what's going to be very interesting with the Chilcot inquiry is now we have Nick Clegg as Deputy Prime Minister. I'm hoping that he will be able to bring a lot more things to light that were covered up by the Labour Party. I don't know what happened, but certainly there seem to be a lot of questions that need to be answered about this. Until they are, people keep speculating.
Yeah, obviously the people will speculate, and I'm very pleased to see that the Coalition are going to set up an independent inquiry into torture and the question of whether British security services are involved in it. Let's try and put these kind of things about the rule of law above party politics, and let's get to the bottom of whatever's gone on, whatever has gone on.
Absolutely.
Well, we're coming up to the Sky News at 6. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Conservative MP for Bristol North West, Charlotte Leslie. See you after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.